Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Global Logistics and Supply Chain Practice Head for Morgan Phillips Executive Search. My job is to connect you with global experts, thought leaders and executives in all things supply chain. I will do my best to pick their brain on leading-edge technologies, sharings on talent development, leadership and key skills for the future, as well as personal success habits. This is episode 2 and it is my pleasure to have as a guest Charles Brewer. He is one of the global figures in logistics, currently CEO of DHL's newest business unit, DHL E-commerce. Stay tuned as we cover key topics in e-commerce globally, discuss skills much needed in the industry, as well as listen to Charles' take on why e-commerce is sexy. Without further ado, here is episode 2. Hello everybody and welcome to our second episode of Leaders in Supply Chain and Logistics podcast. We are delighted to have together with us today Charles Brewer, Global CEO at DHL E-commerce. Charles is a proven expert in supply chain, international shipping and e-commerce with over 32 years of industry experience across Europe, Asia Pacific, Americas and Africa. Charles, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Radu.
So for today, we'll have a series of questions coming from our audience and followers. Broadly, we'll split it into three categories, industry and e-commerce related questions, talent and career development questions, and lastly, questions regarding personal advice that you might want to share with our audience, Charles. Maybe let's first start with a bit of an introduction about yourself, more importantly about DHL e-commerce and e-commerce in general and where the industry is today.
Sure. So thanks, Radu, and thank you to your listeners for listening to this podcast. I hope it's informational. I hope they get a lot out of it. But to the question. So yeah, as you mentioned, 33 years with DHL. I've worked in some fantastic places around the world. I went to 37 out of 52 countries in Africa, which is a beautiful place. For those who have never been to Africa, I highly recommend it. It's a fantastic place. Worked in America, which was incredibly exciting, very energetic, huge organization, huge business over there. And started life in Europe. So I'm UK by birth, English by birth, an Arsenal fan for those football followers out there. Married two lovely children, three dogs, two hamsters and a couple of cats.
So
it's a large family. And yeah, I've been back at, or I've been running DHL e-commerce now for about a year and 3 or 4 months, which is fantastic. It's great. So I obviously love DHL. I've been with DHL for a very long time. It's a great company. One of the world's largest employers, geographically one of the world's largest. I was told a great story once by a National Geographic photographer in Africa, actually, who told me that wherever he was in Africa, could be in a desert, up a mountain, in the forest, wherever he was, there were always two things he could find, DHL and a Coke. So I think that's a great sort of example of how big DHL is geographically.
Brand recognition, yeah.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. And I love e-commerce. So I've been involved in e-commerce, the subject, for the last 3, 4, 5 years. I think most people know it's hugely exciting. Forecasted to be 3.4 trillion by 2020. About a third of that cross-border and two-thirds domestic B2C, growing everywhere. The CEO for DPDHL, Frank Apple, often asked me where next, Charles, and I said, take your pick on a map. It's huge. Yeah. Many markets, hugely embryonic. I mean, although it's been around sort of 5-10 years, it's still incredibly nascent and huge upside. So we're right at the beginning of the product curve, which makes life and every day very, very exciting. But it's also a fair few challenges, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, but that keeps me sane and sensible. So yeah, good stuff.
Thanks for the intro. So we'll deep dive into the industry or e-commerce focused questions. So we've had a couple of very good questions from our audience. So Le Jian Long, actually from Vietnam, he's asking, how do you see DHL e-commerce in the next 5 years? And also if you want to give more specifics into Southeast Asia particularly.
Yeah, and again, thanks for the question. So so I think, you know, we started our e-commerce journey back in 2014, in fact, in Barcelona. Beautiful city as well, by the way. And where we sort of launched our 2020 strategy. And included in our 2020 strategy was three pillars, which was focus, connect and grow. So those are three things we focus, connect and grow. And under our growth pillar, like most mail operators, postal operators around the world, we recognize that e-commerce and the parcel e-commerce business is huge. So we set about developing our strategy towards that and really sort of aiming to be sort of the leading logistics provider for e-commerce, the e-commerce sector. So that started in 2014. And we've been at it now for like 2 or 3 years, and developing our footprints in Europe and the rest of the world. So to the question at hand, I think, first and foremost, we continue that journey. We want to have, we want to position DHL as the provider of choice for the e-commerce sector, particularly around, three main activities. So domestic delivery, so that's pick up in a country, deliver in a country. So all of those who order online get their products when they say they when we say they should, or when they want them. And second one is cross-border. So we focus, obviously, a lot on cross-border, both through our express business, DHL Express business, and also through our e-commerce business units. So that's a huge and growing really, really fast, growing at 27%, or forecast to grow at 27% between now and 2020. So huge opportunity around cross-border. And then the third one is fulfillment. Fulfillment is, again, because I work for DHL, I have a slightly luxurious position that we have a great business unit called DHL Supply Chain, who has the largest footprint of warehouses in the world. And so we access those that footprint to provide pick and pack, kitting, and a few other things besides to do with fulfillment. And I think fulfillment is going to become increasingly more interesting as we go forward. So the way that people order, both domestically and cross-border, is changing almost daily. But one of the sort of key trends is this trend of sort of on-demand. When I order my shirt, I want it in the next day minimally, maybe even same day, in the next hour in some cases. Having product, or allowing customers to put product as close to their consumers as they possibly can, is becoming increasingly important. So both in large markets like the US, where we're seeing sort of what was sort of single warehouses going now to multi-warehouse, or globally where you're doing forward fulfillment or destination fulfillment, where you place product and then you're able to pull from that product inventory and deliver really fast, is growing really quickly. So simplistically, three key areas for us: domestic delivery, cross-border, and fulfillment, and connecting those three to provide an end-to-end solution, I think is one thing. Secondly, in terms of Southeast Asia, Southeast Asia is fantastic. I mean, it's a great example of what I was saying earlier about how embryonic this industry is. So you've got a huge population, 630 plus million people, rapidly and massively changing markets. I was here 10 years ago or so, or 15 years ago, and Southeast Asia has changed hugely in that time. And now the infrastructure is pretty good, despite what people say. I think the infrastructure is pretty good. You've got a very, very young population.
Yeah.
A young population with more disposable income. Very, very tech savvy, internet savvy. So they don't sit at their desktops ordering. They do it from the phones. We know that anything between 30 and 60% of orders, or at least inquiries, come through mobile commerce. So Southeast Asia is really, really exciting. Countries like Indonesia with more than 250 million people. Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, Philippines, all Vietnam, fantastic market. We just opened up there just recently. So Southeast Asia is really, really exciting. We've started our journey in Southeast Asia. And a year or so ago, we opened Thailand. More recently, we opened Malaysia and Vietnam. And there's a couple more to come yet.
Yeah, look forward to it. And I mean, to add on your sharing, I was reading just the other day, I think it was Economic Development Board in Singapore, but there's a few statistics that are just mind-blowing in terms of the growth of Southeast Asia, and it's particularly it's Vietnam, it's Thailand, it's Malaysia, it's Indonesia, it's Philippines. So I think that coupled with the growth of e-commerce, as well as another statistic which was very interesting, is that China will probably be the first nation worldwide to go cashless, and they just it's incredible the way the trajectory goes, and that goes very well with e-commerce trends as well.
Sure.
And people being more and more online savvy, tech savvy, and they just grow with it. So I think it's fantastic markets for you guys.
Yeah, and again, the really exciting, I mean, it's exciting anyway because it's already huge. But it's so embryonic, it's between 3 and 4%, maybe just over 4% of what's bought in shops is bought online, or bought in retail is bought online. So it's 96% upside, which is enormous. It's going to grow at 25% between now and 2020, the e-commerce sector. So huge growth numbers. A few challenges here or there, but generally speaking, massive upside. So I think Southeast Asia is a great example for me of where e-commerce, the subject, sits today. you know, everybody wants to do it. And you, actually, if you go back one question in terms of why, probably the other question is why. Why is e-commerce so exciting in the first place? Why are people buying online? Mm. If you take, and you know, again, just give you one or two examples. So, you know, I think the Philippines have something like 2,700 islands. Indonesia with 250 million people, the biggest archipelago. You know, they just don't have access to stores and shops in the same way as, you know, respectfully, if you're in London, it's a very different environment. You don't have to walk out your door and you can buy those trainers or the laptop or the phone anywhere, you know. So a lot of these markets, you know, a lot of consumers don't have immediate access to the products that they want to have access to. So, you know, that's what's driving this growth. And, you know, that sort of, again, going back to the point about it's still very embryonic, but if you, you know, you look at the US and the shuttering of retail stores, which is huge, I mean, absolutely enormous. Somebody asked the other day, you know, is it too late? I said, I think, look, the train's left the station. So huge growth, and Southeast Asia, huge growth opportunity. Lots of people, please carry on shopping online. It's been fun.
Exactly. Yeah. A very good question also from Krishna. Thank you, Krishna. She was asking, how do you see e-commerce and retail in the future? Will they compete, coexist? Will there be synergies? I think it's a question on a lot of people's minds.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's sort of where I ended the last question, which is, you know, I think, you know, if you think about it logically, I was asked this just recently. I was in Australia just recently. I was down there doing a business review with a team and looking at that market, which is also very exciting. And I was asked during an interview, so why? Why do people shop online? You know, and I was explaining that I'd been away for a couple of weeks and I was going home that weekend. And, you know, if my wife said to me, look, we need to go and buy some toothbrush and toothpaste, you know, do I want to do that? Or do I want to spend the morning, my 2 days at home with my children? And the answer is I want to spend the 2 days at home with my children. So I think there are a number of factors that are driving people away from retail. One is, you know, it's relatively inconvenient for what people want to do with their lives. Secondly, people, you know, now you have choice. You can have things delivered to your house. You can have things delivered to the back of your car. You can have things delivered by drone or whatever method. So it's much more convenient to have it to shop online. There's much more choice online. So I think, you know, if you look at sort of statistically, and again, as I mentioned, the US has seen this huge shuttering of retail stores. I think the biggest in the last 10 years or so, or the largest number of shops are closed in the last 10 years or so. So, again, the evidence empirically points towards a pretty tough environment for the retail segment. That said, I think some of the stories that are written around it, retail is dead, I think are far too premature. You know, and to answer the question, I think there is a space and a reason why both would coexist. I think it's important for the retail sector, as some already have started to do, is to understand how do you remain relevant in today's world. You know, so if you accept, and lots of retail owners don't want to accept it, but if you accept that I don't want to drive down on a Saturday morning to buy a toothbrush, then there has to be a different reason as to why I go to the shop in the first place. And we're starting to see some evidence around retail, big retail malls, shifting and changing how they remain relevant, so becoming far much more around family entertainment centres with ice skating cinemas, restaurants, etc. In fact, the fastest growth in any mall is restaurant food. So, you know, I think recognising how you remain relevant, number one. Number two, and that's a good example. Number two, you know, in the e-commerce sector and the consumer in particular, they want convenience and choice. That's really important for the consumer. And again, historically, you know, 94% of all deliveries were made to door, to the doorstep. But the consumer doesn't want that. That's just how it was. They didn't have any other choice. Now there is other choices, and they are starting to say, we want more choice. So, you know, the consumer, and again, if I take myself as an example, that same example of the toothbrush and toothpaste, the Saturday morning that I'm going to spend with my children will probably be in the park or at the water park or wherever it may be. Therefore, I'm not at home to receive the delivery. Therefore, I would much rather pick it up from somewhere on the way back and just drive through and pick it up, or get out of the car and pick it up, or whatever it may be. So I think, you know, the whole click and collect opportunity for retail is significant. And again, I think my last point on the subject is, so in summary, I absolutely believe they can coexist, although I do believe that e-commerce is going to grow and is growing much, much faster than what retail will. So, you know, to carry on doing what retail does, I think, is wrong. You've got to shift and pivot your proposition. But the last point is that, you know, leverage what you have as a strength, and the strength you have is placement. And You know, if you've got 10 stores, then there's 10 stores that can be used as collection points for customers. If you've got one, it's one store. If you've got one store, omnichannel, you know, look at how you create an environment in your store where, you know, again, it's statistically proven today. A lot of people do a lot of research online and then go to the store. So make sure your store operates in the same fashion that they shop online. So, you know, again, there's lots of examples out there of becoming very using technology and digital to make sure the store experience is as good as shopping online, if not better. It should be better. So I think, you know, in summary, absolutely can coexist. You just need to rethink how you remain relevant.
Yeah. No, and absolutely. And I mean, it's not black and white, and it's not e-commerce will not kill traditional, not the other way around. It's just a matter of we struggle as humans to adapt fast enough sometimes, and that's the only I guess that's the only thing. Another good question from Kang Ha, who's wondering, do you see the growth of e-commerce as a threat to the traditional freight industry? Does it mean that more orders coming from e-commerce, that means less freight moved by traditional sea freight, air freight? Any figures, evidence to prove it?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting question. And I think succinctly, and without sitting on the fence too much, it's an opportunity and a threat. And the threat is that obviously that if you're ordering B2C, if the consumer's ordering a single phone from a supplier as opposed to the shop ordering multiple phones, then there is some threat towards large palletized shipping of goods. The opportunity is that if you look at how the e-tailers, the marketplaces and the retailers want to operate, they're looking to lower the cost of distribution as best they possibly can. So we have some really good evidence and working on a lot of projects around how do we move low value B2C goods, e-commerce goods, particularly out of China, into other regions, but without necessarily flying it, as an example. So I'll give you, or flying it, but flying it at less cost. So as an example, we're working very hard on developing a road freight solution into Southeast Asia out of China. So today, for the most part, it is flown. The products are flown, but there's a great opportunity to road freight. If you take Vietnam out of southern China, it's very easy to get product from there to into Vietnam. Now, there are some governance and legislative issues around how you do that, and we're working very, very hard to overcome those with the governments and various other stakeholders. But I think that's a great example of how the freight forwarding industry can see e-commerce as a great opportunity. So developing road freight solutions, similarly with air freight, so again, most e-tailers are working on how, if when they do have to fly it, how can they fly it at a lower cost, and air freight is a great solution. It's just about how you connect that air freight solution into a last mile provider. So I suppose if any of your listeners are in the air freight sector, we have plenty of last mile solutions, and you can connect into ours anywhere you like. So we've already developed a good solution using our freight forwarding sister company, DHL Global Forwarding, where we air freight out of China, inject into Southeast Asia, clear locally, and then inject into the last mile, our last mile solution, which I think is, from the consumer's perspective, it gives them something between super fast and super slow at a more cost-effective price for the shipper. So again, like I said, I think there are some threats to it, definitely, but I think it's like everything in life, you just have to look at it and say, well, what's the opportunity? And there's plenty of opportunities for the freight forwarder sector too.
Absolutely. I mean, being relatively close to the industry myself, I'm just I guess the again just like with traditional brick and mortar shops, the question to the 3PLs is, are they fast enough to move, to adapt, to become e-commerce savvy or not?
Sure.
But that's again back to the point of being adaptable, right?
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing in life, Ruddy. And you see it so often, unfortunately, in business, that there's sort of a bit of an ostrich mentality to opportunities or threats, which is, if I stay close, my ears closed enough, it won't affect me. The reality is e-commerce is going to affect everybody, the e-commerce sector. So the trick is just to sit back in a darkened room and think about how do I play in that space, not how do I fight that space. The train has left the station, so you can't stop it. It's now about how do you successfully create a sustainable product and business in a very fast growing environment. I don't think in our lifetimes we won't see such a massive impact on the logistics sector that e-commerce will present. So you better be on the right wave and treat it as the upside as opposed to the other.
Don't stand in front of the train, right?
Yeah.
Alexander Maxwell, which I think is a good friend from, yeah. So he asks, what are some of the e-commerce trends other than, so he gave an example, so e-commerce delivery lead times moving closer to get it now solutions. What other big trends do you see coming up for the e-commerce?
Yeah, so I mean, and I mentioned fulfillment already. I think that's really, really important and going to grow in importance because, as I mentioned, this sort of whole consumer on-demand culture is growing really rapidly. So, you know, the example I always give whenever I'm on stage is, you know, use my wife as an example, who is an international shopper, a professional e-commerce shopper, much to my disgust. But you know, when she first started shopping online, it was, and we were living in America at the time, I can remember, you know, she would say to me, oh, you know, just shopping domestically, it's going to take 3 to 6 days to get delivered. And she thought that was fantastic. She thought that was amazing that it would be 3 to 6 hours. In fact, when we moved to New York and the food delivery was sort of same day late in the evening, she thought that was even more amazing. But if you said to her today, it's going to be 3 to 6 days, she would look at you like you're a Martian, you know. So, you know, the expectation of the consumer has changed significantly. So I think fulfillment's going to play a huge part in satisfying that change, in particular destination fulfillment. So that's number one. And linked to that, number two, you know, again, historically, cross-border was called cross-border. I don't think it is anymore. I think people just shop.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think the sort of, you know, which is great news, I think, for many, many, many people, which is, you know, if you're an SME in Malaysia who makes great batik shirts, the world is your oyster. People from all over the world will buy them. If you're in Africa making garments there, same thing. You know, so I think the despite recent political noises from various countries around sort of becoming more parochial, I don't think it is. I think the world is much, much smaller. I think the borders are becoming much, much simpler, more simpler, simple. And the ability and therefore the availability for people to buy from one country to another country is becoming easier and easier and easier. So I think we're going to see, and statistically it says that we're going to grow at 27%. So we're going to see this sort of rise of people shopping from anywhere,
yeah,
buying anything from anywhere in the world. And it'll get faster as well. So we're seeing those sort of speeds coming down. I think on that point, the third trend would be speed. So, you know, give you a good example, going back about 4 or 5 years ago in the US, the average delivery times were sort of 5 to 6 days. Now they're 2 to 3.
Yeah.
So those sort of speeds of delivery, both domestically and cross-border, are coming down because people want to, their tolerance for time is less. So people want things faster. I think we're going to see that. And then the last one, I think we're going to see this sort of rise and rise of alternate delivery approaches. So, so if you remember, we're sitting here in Singapore today looking out on the city of Singapore, and the Singapore government worked really hard and think about it a lot because they involve DHL an awful lot on how do we ensure that the roads and the city keeps moving.
Yeah.
And if you think about, as I said earlier on, the sort of where we are in terms of the product development. So the example I always give is Indonesia. Indonesia, I think it's something like, you know, less than 1% of what's bought is bought online. But that less than 1% of what's bought represents 850,000 parcels a day. We imagine when it gets to 5 or 10 or 20%. And the same is true for Singapore and the same is true for Malaysia. So I think you can't keep pushing the pig through the python. You know, the roads are going to clog and you know, cities are going to slow down. And that's not where I think all of us want to get to. So we work hard on innovations around how do we get the order delivered to a customer without necessarily being in a car. Or a bike, for that matter.
Yeah.
So I think that we're going to see that alternate delivery solution coming both from the logistics providers, who have to, for lots of reasons, but cost being one of them. We're going to see that change to alternate deliveries because the cities are going to demand it. The major metros in the world, you know, the Jakartas of the world, the Nairobis, the Lagoses, the all the big cities in the world are going to sort of demand that logistics players find alternate solutions. And I think the consumer is too. I think the consumer, to my point earlier on, it's a win-win for everybody because I don't think the consumer really wants it delivered to door. I mean, they should still have that choice, but I think actually they want the flexibility to have their order wherever and whenever they want it. So I think that's probably the fourth trend I think we're going to see coming along. And it's already coming up, but changing pretty soon.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And a follow-up question, Alexander was also asking about technology trends. So he mentions, okay, Internet of Things, you know, everybody's talking about it. Okay, blockchain is another key buzzword that's spoken a lot. He actually specifically asked about the Internet of IoT, right? So he's asking, in your view, what does IoT deliver in practical terms for e-commerce at DHL? Mm. Are we ahead or behind of the development curve?
Mm. I think, well, the Internet of Things is obviously a nice trending subject, and lots of people are working on it. But in terms of reality, the reality of how do we see that play in the business today, it's probably still fairly nascent. It's not really developed just yet. But I suppose, like DHL, many companies are working on how can they use that. I mean, from our perspective, I think there's probably two key areas that we're working very hard on in terms of how do we use data in particular to improve life. One is, you know, we capture, obviously delivering hundreds of thousands of packages every day around the world, we capture a lot of data about consumer behavior, when they order, where they order, how they have it delivered, do they have a dog, do they not have a dog. You know, so we have a lot of data that is incredibly useful for lots of people, including us, but also for the marketplaces and retailers. So there's an opportunity for us to potentially commercialize that data and use that data to, obviously for the marketplaces, but also for also for improving our operations.
And customizing your delivery, yeah, correct.
Yeah, so that's number one. Number two is predictive data. So the more data you have and the more you use that data, the more we can actually predict when you're going to order. So we would know, Radu, that you order a pizza on a Tuesday at 6 p.m. typically, and if we know that, we can stage and plan our organisation accordingly. So I think in particular for us, it's really about that sort of using the data in the form of data lakes, or commercialising the data, or using the data to either make the customer experience much better or make our operation more efficient. I think that's probably the biggest areas we're going to see change over the next few months. And the last point on tech is that, and I think I made the point on LinkedIn, is that. And I didn't really appreciate this when I first came into the e-commerce space, but I do now. For logistics organizations to be successful in this space and to capitalize on the massive growth, but also deliver a sustainable product, technology underpins everything, absolutely everything. So, you know, again, I think as an organization, we've realized that, if we didn't realize it already, over the last couple of years. And so we're investing very heavily in making sure we have the very, very best technology that allows us to really orchestrate routes that are the most efficient whilst providing a great customer experience. And that all comes from technology. I mean, great people, we have fantastic people. But the key in the e-commerce space, especially when you're dealing with pretty low margins, is that technology piece.
Yeah. Now, coming back to the part with the challenges of e-commerce. So there's a good question from, actually it's kind of similar questions from Jonathan Town and Brian Hang. They're more or less asking, how can you actually make money in e-commerce? But I'll give you some some context to it. So for example, Brian is saying that many e-commerce players are so flooded with shareholders' money, they seem that they have no issues in building in-house fulfillment, last delivery capabilities. You know, we've seen Lazada acquiring Redmart in Singapore. Redmart is an e-commerce supermarket. Small niche players locally, like Reborns, they're building their warehouses. Brick Mortar Luxasia, there's another example close to Southeast Asia, is going into e-commerce. But I guess the bottom line, kind of underlining question is, can you actually, you know, on the long term, make this as a successful and profitable? Because it seems like a lot of people are throwing, you know, Amazon, I've read the statistics, they lost $1 billion delivery last year. Of course, they're making it up in other ways, but what's your thoughts on that?
I think it's a... I'll give you three thoughts. One is that, you know, the playbook hasn't been written. So there is not many off-the-shelf examples you can take and say, that's the model that guarantees that answer, that you can make money and have a sustainable product. So I think all of us who are playing in this space recognize a huge opportunity, recognize a growth opportunity, and now are working out, innovating and trialing different methods to see which one actually delivers a sustainable product. So that's number one. Number two, from our perspective, that means that, as I mentioned earlier on, we know that technology is definitely, you know, the platform that gives you the best chance to create a sustainable solution from a fiscal perspective. So we're investing very heavily in the technology side, and aligned to that, we're testing different models. So and I think here we're talking more about the last mile than fulfillment and cross-border. Fulfillment and cross-border already demonstrate they can make money. So this is and this is more specifically related to the last mile, the courier driving the van or the bike to deliver the product. So and for those who are sort of unfamiliar with the question, the context, the reason why it's a relevant question is that unlike international shipping, where you know, the selling price could be, I don't know, between $30 and $60 for a half kilo package going around the world, in the e-commerce space, if you take Singapore, it's about $3 to $5 for a next day delivery. In Indonesia, it's less than $2. So the selling price in many of the markets for domestic delivery is pretty low, and you have a similar cost base. So it means the margins are much, much smaller, and it's much, much more difficult to make money, which is to the question. So to answer that, technology underpins it. So the better your technology, the more orchestration you do, and dynamic orchestration you do, to ensure that your courier routes are built the most efficient way possibly, the better. So again, 31 years ago when I started my life in DHL, we would hand sort packages, looking up in A to Z manuals where addresses were and stuff like that. You know, if you come at this in a manual way, you're going to die pretty quickly. It's you know, there'll be a bit of a bloodbath in terms of the financial results. So you have to use technology to really orchestrate the most efficient route you possibly can. And you know, so if you go to our Thailand operation or to our Malaysia or Vietnam, we don't see supervisors or managers standing around looking at packages. It's all done the day before. It's all done through technology, with live algorithms that are constantly taking in feeds. It's really incredible. I mean, it you know, the system we use, which we partner with a great company, takes in feeds from weather, traffic, road closures, police escorts, whatever's happening on the streets of Singapore or Malaysia or Vietnam or Thailand or Chile or the US or India, wherever it is we operate, it takes in real life feeds and orchestrates that courier route to make it the most efficient. So, again, as an example, for those who may not be so acutely aware of it, so, you know, if a courier goes out in the morning with 80 parcels and he heads off down the road and that road's closed because there's a government minister going through, that's pretty much your day done.
And a lot of clients that are, or customers that are disgruntled.
Yeah, and a lot of customers aren't happy. So so you lose customers, they don't go back on the shopping platform, your costs go through the roof, and to the question, you don't make money. So you have to you can't take this sort of static view of streets and the environment you operate in. It has to be more agile and nimble. So we use a lot of technology to really orchestrate those routes in an agile way, so that we're constantly updating and makes it as efficient as it possibly can be, which gives great customer satisfaction, but also means that our couriers operate at the best possible efficiency going forward. So that's number one. Number two is, you know, there are sort of two ends of the spectrum. There is asset heavy and asset light, and there are lots of bits in between. But if we take the two extremes, you know, in Thailand, for example, we operate fully asset heavy yellow platform. So the van is yellow, the building is yellow, the courier is DHL. So it's very, very much a yellow solution. And that comes with a cost, but it also means you get great service quality, great brand ownership, etc. And then the other extreme is, and we're testing this as well, is an asset light model. So a crowdsourced or elastic delivery model, which is more like the Cainiao model, which Alibaba operate, where you own the technology and then you plug in the delivery providers. And the delivery provider could be a mother going home from a sport event through to you after interviewing me, through to whoever else. You just use your available capacity to go and do a delivery. And we're trialing that in America, in Chicago and Los Angeles. And so we're trialing both with the intent of trying to find what provides the best consumer experience, what provides the best customer, the shipper experience, and also what provides the best cost experience. Yeah. And when we get to the right answer, I'll tell you and let you know how we do it. But again, I go back to the original point I made, which is, take Indonesia. There's 850,000 parcels there a day. If we can work out the right mousetrap, we can make money. Sure.
Yeah. Perfect. And then among the final questions, if we were to ask you, can you simplify in a few sentences the most striking challenges you've had to overcome when you set up, and you're still overcoming, I'm guessing, when you set up DHL e-commerce and now?
Well, we're very lucky we don't experienced probably some of the challenges that startups face. If you go to a new country as a startup, you know, you have all sort of regulatory and legal aspects of setting up a new organization. Some countries can be really painful. So very thankfully, DHL's been around for a long time. So we have great relationships and great history and great experience in most of these markets. So we don't face those. So our challenges typically come, you know, to your trend and your trade, which is people. So e-commerce is still, as I said a number of times, very embryonic. So trying to find people with the experience in the space is quite tough. So it's not like traditional logistics where you can find a lot of people that worked in logistics industry for a long time. Not many people have worked in the e-commerce sector for a long time. So that's probably, you know, one of the challenges is finding great people that fit our culture, fit our organization, fit the experience we're looking for, and fit the sort of markets we want to work in. So that's number one. Second one is as I mentioned earlier, the infrastructure can be occasionally interesting. You know, you have to, and again, I think we're lucky because we have years of experience of working in environments that are sometimes very challenging. But if you're new to it and you go to some of these cities and some of the countries we operate in and you get floods or situations, it's not easy. So infrastructure can certainly be a challenge. I think from an e-commerce perspective, you know, the challenges we face from a delivery perspective are the same as, you know, every other e-commerce logistics company that's operating in this space. It's all about trying to, you know, keep the shipper, the seller, as happy as you possibly can. And their happiness derives out of how happy you keep the consumer and also the price you charge. So that can be a challenge. Secondly, and obviously the consumer, you know, often, as I said earlier, 94% of all deliveries are still to door, and that can be challenging. Actually, addresses in that was more of a negative experience than I expected. So I know that the Middle East has challenges with their addresses. I know that some countries in Africa have challenges. I didn't expect that in Southeast Asia, but Thailand is still quite challenging in terms of finding locations and addresses. So is Vietnam, actually. So address identification can be a bit challenging. And going back to my point earlier around orchestrating, that adds cents and costs, dollars and costs. So that can be a bit of an experience as well. Getting the delivery off to the consumer first time is an ongoing challenge for the e-commerce logistics provider. But I mean, and you know me, Radu, I tend to see these things more as opportunities than real challenges. That's what keeps us happier during a day. You know, we've got to work out the answers.
Exactly. I mean, if it wasn't hard, everybody would do it.
Correct. Yeah.
And you know, you can't make a lot of money if everybody's doing
correct.
It. So.
Correct.
And like everything in life, it takes time. So
Yep.
But that brings me to the point of the next grouping of questions, and I guess it's about people, and I guess it was a nice leeway into the challenge of finding the right people. I do come from that business, from executive search, from trying to find solutions to the people challenges that organizations face. And truthfully, you know, obviously I operate in this space of logistics supply chain. Logistics is not sexy. I mean, there is just...
I disagree, by the way, but come on.
Yeah, I know you disagree, but I wanted to prompt you with that. I mean, it's not banking. I'm not sure how sexy banking is nowadays. Maybe fintech is sexy nowadays. It's not IT, it's not technology. So historically, it's not perceived as a sexy place. Now, I guess my question is twofold. So first, challenge me on that part with why you think it's sexy. But secondly, also, how can we make, you know, how can we attract the brightest minds, the guys that finish, you know, I don't know, the top schools into the industry?
I think the answer is similar for both, actually, which is, and to the point around, I do think e-commerce is sexy. I tend to agree somewhat. I mean, I'm a bit biased. I've been in logistics for 32 years. I tend to agree that sort of some of these sort of more traditional logistics elements are perhaps not as sexy as some other business units. But I think e-commerce is really sexy, you know. So, you know, I get to wear jeans. I don't have to wear a suit, except when I go to Germany. So we get to wear normal clothes. We have younger people, much younger than me. I think the one good thing is that most of the younger population that's coming through and looking for jobs, I think they see the e-commerce sector, as pretty exciting. And therefore, by default, and I can only tell you from my experience, you know, by default, I get, you know, a huge number of applications from, you know, young people that just qualified out of universities or younger people in sort of starting out their careers who I think are the right type of people that we want to attract into this sector. So that's probably a little bit sort of a byproduct of the fact that we're called DHL e-commerce, and therefore there's probably an element of e-commerce. So I take some time to explain that we're still the logistics arm of e-commerce. We're not actually doing selling and building marketplaces and so on and so forth. But I think it's a bit more exciting than perhaps some of the other BUs. But that, I'm biased. So that's number one. Number two, as I said earlier on, it is really quite challenging finding, especially when we go into a new market and we're selling an organization. So, you know, when we went into Vietnam, we were really super lucky to hire, you know, a great country manager, and he in turn has hired a really great team. But I know it hasn't been easy, and for the reasons I mentioned earlier on, because we want people with the attitude and the characteristics of startup, the energy, the drive, the agility, the laissez-faire approach to what I wear to work, whatever else. So we want the characteristics of a startup, but you're coming to work for DHL, which is, you know, top 10 employer in the world, and we have all the bureaucracies and layers and governance that you would expect for a very large organization. So it's quite challenging to find the right person that fits both that sort of startup agility sort of characteristic versus, you know, working and operating in a very large organization. So that's been quite challenging. And then, as I mentioned earlier, if we're looking for particular functional roles, there's not a lot of people out there who've got years of experience in e-commerce. So, you know, the swimming pool of talent is quite shallow in terms of that experience. But I have to say, and so whenever we start in a market, I always go in there with, you know, this will be another challenging time to go and find the right people. But to date, we've been really, really successful. So, you know, all of the new, and we're starting up new markets, you know, virtually every other month. And all the markets where we started, the teams to date have been really fantastic, really great people. And I think, you know, for us, and, you know, that's kind of quite interesting in itself, because having highly motivated and great people is sort of the cornerstone of Deutsche Post DHL. So whether it be DHL Express or DHL Global Forwarding or DHL Supply Chain, DHL Freight or DHL E-commerce or DHL Parcel Europe, we look for people that are going to be great. And to date, I have to say, in e-commerce, we've done that pretty well. So I think it is a challenge, but the end result seems to be worth it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I mean, it's also, I mean, again, the challenge in itself consists of a great opportunity, because, I mean, there's also the reality that the e-commerce being new, you don't necessarily need the traditional type of a background. I mean, you can also train, and you can form, and you can have a good pipeline and you know, leadership development, so on and so forth.
We're writing the chapter each day, there's no history here, you're not coming in and saying, oh, this is how we've always done it, because we haven't always done it.
Yeah.
We're pretty new. And that's really exciting, you know. So you go to these countries which are just starting out, and, you know, so I was in Malaysia fairly recently, and I asked the country manager, Jason Kong, look, make sure the office doesn't feel like a DHL office. Make sure it feels like a startup. It should have, that's how we want to operate. We want the culture to be very young, very lively, very agile, very nimble, test and fail, test and succeed, you know, very customer-centric.
Yeah.
So I went there, and he'd built this sort of plastic grass pitch with these, I call them love swings, but they're some sort of swing that you sit in, and they're hysterical, you know. So whenever I go there, I sit in there. It takes me a while to get out of them, actually. But it's really exciting, because when other DHLers go there, DHLers who've been around DHL for a long time, they go there and go, what on earth is going on? But that's kind of what we want to build, you know. So we have the luxury of, as you say, of being much more towards the startup side than towards traditional DHL.
And as you said, I mean, to the point also that typically in e-commerce, I mean, if we look at the age, you know, the age of the people that tend to enter the industry and the market, I mean, they tend to be young.
Yeah.
Or if they're not young, they're very young at heart, like yourself, right? And it's a different vibe. I mean, it's a different attitude. It's a different mentality. They're very switched on, very fast-paced. Of course, I mean, that also means that not everybody can just put up with it. I mean, not put up with it, but just it's not for everybody. But if you have that drive, I think it's a very fulfilling. It can be a very fulfilling environment to be in, and it's very stimulating.
One would almost say sexy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there you go. You made me fix my words. Irene was asking. So she brought up the global talent shortage in supply chain. One of the major root causes for this is aging workforce, companies not taking steps to create or feed their future talent pipeline. she's from the African continent. I think it applies to other continents, to most of the, all of the other continents as well. I think this is more broader than just e-commerce, but it's asking the question, what steps or initiatives is the industry taking in order to rectify this, and specifically, what is DHL Group? So it's a little broader, but if
no, it's great. No, it's great. And I think when Irene and I traded a few emails on, or a few messages on LinkedIn, I particularly love this question, because it goes right to something I'm very passionate about, which is diversity. You know, so if you look at sort of unemployment rates around the world, in the US, in the UK, in France, Germany, they're the lowest they've ever been for a long, long, long time. So really low, low, low unemployment rates, which means regardless of whether you work for DHL e-commerce or anybody else for that matter, if you're employing a lot of people, which we are, it's tough, it's challenging, because you know a lot of our sort of blue collar workers are at the lower sort of pay side of life, and that's a really competitive space. So if you looked in the US just recently, Amazon were hiring 50,000 employees in a week, I think, if I remember rightly, or for their coming up for their peak period,
correct.
They're hiring in a sort of very, you know, not surprisingly, in the same sort of metros we're hiring. So it just, what was already competitive is becoming more competitive. So, you know, so I think, and that's true wherever you look in the world. If you want to hire in Singapore, you want to hire in Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Japan, wherever you're hiring, it's more competitive today to hire than it was, you know, a few years ago. So what does that mean? It means, I think, three things. One is you have to be employer choice, or try to be employer choice. So we work really, really hard as a group, not just DHL e-commerce, to position DHL as a great place to work. We've won lots of awards for it, but that's meaningless. It's more about, you know, creating a culture where people enjoy coming to work. We want, you know, we really want people who come into our environment, whether, you know, in the warehouse, in the office, wherever they're working, to actually quite like it. And I know that sounds a pretty obvious statement to make, but you'd be surprised at how many people don't like where they work.
I'm not surprised. I talk to them every day.
I was going to say, for you, you know. But there are a lot of people out there who, you know, and you know the numbers probably better than I do, but you know, something like a third of the world's workforce are either disengaged or on the fence, which means they're not fully engaged. And if they're not fully engaged, they're not giving of their best, they're not really customer-centric, they're not really focused on providing a great service. Yeah. So we work really, really hard to try and move that. You know, the third that are super excited and the third that are sort of on the fence, keep pushing them to be even more super excited and more happy, because if you do, they'll provide an even better service. The third that are completely disengaged, you probably lost them already, and you should work out how to separate and shake hands as quickly as possible. But so again, Irene, to your question, you know, the first point is work really hard to position yourself to be employer choice. And I have to be honest, from a DHL e-commerce perspective, you know, until about a year ago, I'm not so sure we did that very well. I don't think we were positioning DHL e-commerce as a great place to come and work. If you want to come and work in the e-commerce related logistics sector, you probably want to go and work for one of the marketplaces or someone else. So we've worked really, really hard to sort of put DHL e-commerce on the map externally. So speaking at events, Cheryl spends, who heads up our marketing, spends a lot of time positioning DHL externally in the right formats, so that we have a place, we have a space, we have a voice. And if you do that, people say, oh, that's interesting, I'd like to come and learn more. And we see the number of applications has gone up considerably. Yeah. So that's number one. Number two is, when you hire somebody, when you bring somebody into the organization, make sure you love the hell out of them. I mean, from that first moment they say yes, or indeed thinking about saying yes, from that first moment you interact with them, the experience better be amazing. In fact, I was talking to one of my country managers about this over the weekend, that I'd seen a couple of, you know, prospective employees who wrote to me and said, hey, I haven't heard. And I said, that just is not acceptable, because you're creating a brand, you're managing the brand in the marketplace, and those people that don't hear back will tell 20 other people, I never heard back. So you just got to operate really correctly from moment of interest through to hiring and onboarding and all the way through their career. You have to work much harder these days to keep the employees super engaged and motivated. So that's number two. And number three, I think, to the point around diversity, and this one's really important for me. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I was in Africa for 5 years, and when I first went there, we had something like 16% of our leadership were female. When I left, it was 40%, or more than 40%. And everybody said, "Well, in Africa, you can't have female leaders." And I said, "Rubbish!" You know. Mm. And as organizations, we need to work really hard to recognize there are big populations in diverse categories that we have to be attractive to.
Yeah.
It's not just females, by the way. It's diversity in general. And again, to your point earlier on about sort of logistics, I'm not sure it's always the most attractive for all segments, but my thought around that is that you can change that. You can make it more attractive for all categories and for all persons of whatever religion, sex, race, or whatever else. Again, we started this journey about 9 months ago around becoming a much more diverse employer in DHL e-commerce, DP, DHL, Deutsche Post, DHL has been doing it for a long time, but particularly for e-commerce. And I think to date the results are starting to show that we really can become an employer of choice for all categories as well. So I think that's really important. Again, going back to Irene's question around, there is a shortage of talent, there is a shortage of prospective employees. And if you disengage from one category or one segment, that can be a big part of the population. So we want to be a very diverse employer. There's lots of benefits that come with it in terms of getting different thoughts and all the rest of it, but I think just covering that one question is a really, really good reason to ensure that you're an equal opportunity employer, and you really do try and create a great place for people to work, of regardless of where they come from and who they are.
Absolutely. And I mean, like, to your point with making sure that people are well taken care of or looked at all throughout the hiring process, it's almost like HR nowadays, and I've had this discussion with several of my clients as well. HR has to function as marketing as well, as branding departments as well. I mean, it's a very fine line where it should be together, because this is the world we live in. People have choices.
People have choices.
People talk and people have social media. Mm. And you really, I mean, if you upset somebody, they will take it to the social media and your brand will be hit. And it's just not something that you would want to do.
And you hear it. I mean, you hear it in the marketplace if you don't operate. Well, you hear about great companies to work for, people love to work for. And I hear it in Singapore. I hear certain companies mentioned more than others. And I also hear in Singapore, companies they wouldn't people want to work for. So we don't want to be one on the right. We want to be definitely the company that people want to work for. So we work, to your point, we work very hard and still need to work harder on making sure we brand correctly externally.
Good question from Mac Sullivan. He's actually asking, how could we better train our staff to be outside of the box thinkers who are constantly looking to optimize our customer supply chain rather than just be a piece in the mechanism, a wheel in the chain?
I think it's a bit about making sure. Well, I think it's really important to make sure you explain what part of the cog they are. Everybody, from the sorter, from the, in my business, the people that sort of encode packages in warehouses, through to delivery, through to whoever, really making sure they understand what part in the process they play. That's number one. Number two, celebrate them. Celebrate the hell out of them, traditionally, I've seen certain functions get more celebration than others, and I think that's wrong. I think you've really got to celebrate everybody's contribution to the organization as best you possibly can. Thirdly, we have a really, really fantastic training and development program, which in our business unit is called PEP Expert, and every single person from the CEO down to the ops agent in the warehouse goes through the same program. And myself included, so we're all on the same page. And again, I think it's not fair for me to comment just purely on DHL, because I know lots of your listeners aren't working for big companies and some are small, but we're fairly lucky that the culture of DHL is very much a family. So we don't tend to be too hierarchical in the first place. So if I go to a warehouse, I'll have lunch with couriers, go out on courier rides, whatever else. So when it's just the way we operate. It's just the way we work. I think that's a real positive, which means that people do feel very inclusive in the organization in the first place.
And what do you see as talent gaps in the industry in e-commerce right now? What skills is the industry lacking badly at the moment in e-commerce?
It's more, like I said earlier on, it's really that sort of e-commerce logistics experience. So, selling, if you're a salesperson, selling e-commerce logistics or express or freight forwarding is probably fairly similar, so it's very transferable. But that operating e-commerce logistics experiences, you have to learn, you have to really have done it, working, particularly around, I said earlier on about orchestrating routes, the technology side of e-commerce operations, that's probably the tougher part. The rest, not so much. It's more that operate front, it's the front end piece that I think is somewhat slimmer in terms of depth of available talent, but it's changing. And again, what are we doing about it? We're working really hard to create sort of universities within sort of e-commerce where we, today, if one of our country managers left, I hope it doesn't happen, by the way, but if it, one of them did, we would probably have to replace externally. Because we haven't developed our people through yet, having only really been going sort of a year and a half, 2 years. But you know, the next sort of 2 or 3 years, that'll change. And sort of the normal Deutsche Post DHL, the normal DHL way is very much to focus on grooming and growing talent internally. So, aside of the many other things we're doing around the world, we're also working really, really hard on talent management and getting those sort of high performers through so they're ready to take over the next level.
Super. And actually, there was a question in terms of how do you, I mean, if you can give some details in terms of how do you develop these future leaders, and how, is there certain things that DHL is, and I know that you have a very strong culture and a very rich history as well in terms of the other groups, but is there certain particular programs you're applying
e-commerce? So we follow the sort of very normal DHL way, which is sort of the 70-20-10, which is 70% is on the job. So we really work hard to give people experience on the front line. So Cheryl, as I mentioned earlier on, who heads up marketing, is very keen for some very bizarre reason to go and learn about sales and sales management. So we're going to dispatch her off to a country to experience being a sales manager for a period of time, and then she learns that and she come back and she stays there or whatever else. So I think, and again, you know, from my 33 years in DHL, I learned the most from doing, not from listening. And, you know, I can remember the very first budget I was given, which in those days was all paper-based. And I looked to the person who gave it to me and said, what do you want me to do this? He said, learn. so I wrote my very first budget on my own with no experience. And I made loads of mistakes, but that's how you learn, yeah?
Yeah.
So that sort of culture is still very, very strong within DHL. A lot of entrepreneurial type activities where we give people the opportunity to go and do new things, learn and fail or succeed. So all of our projects were run by existing DHL people who are sort of positioned in there and say, right, go and do that for 6 months or 9 months or whatever else. So 70% on the job, and then the rest we supplement that with. Again, if I use Cheryl, I've used Cheryl lots of times, but if I use Cheryl as an example, so she's also doing an external digital course right now, and Cheryl's in the room with us, by the way, so just in case. So she's doing, so the sort of 20% and 10% of formal, the 10% formal training or external training is a good example. So Cheryl's doing digital social training externally as well. So we balance that 70-20-10, but 70% on the job, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic, fantastic. And I mean, yeah, we learn best when we are involved,
yep.
Right?
So, yep.
And final, I mean, kind of leeway question into our next segment is, you know, if somebody in their 20s, maybe somebody starting up in DHL e-commerce, just fresh off the oven, if they were to ask you how to become the CEO of DHL e-commerce in a few years, what kind of advice would you share?
Well, they may not need to wait a few years. That's the first probably advice I give them. I think, you know, I'm often asked, you know, what advice would you give, you know, younger DHLers, and my advice is always very constant, which is it's all about attitude. I really believe that. I think, again, DHL is not a proxy for every company or every industry, but certainly in DHL, we care far more about someone's attitude than necessarily their educational experience or what college they went to or what university degree they got. We really care about how they apply themselves in the workplace. And, you know, so most when we're having talent discussions, we talk a lot about EQ. Of course, we talk about IQ as well, but we talk a lot about EQ, their ability to learn, their ability to take risks, their ability to create trusting environments, their ability to deliver results. So we focus a lot on their sort of leadership attributes, their behaviours, as opposed to necessarily, you know, the quantifiable hard facts about what school they went to or wherever else. So my advice to a younger person, if they want to be a CEO of e-commerce, is first of all, think twice. And secondly, secondly, you have to push me out of the way. And thirdly, yeah, go for it. It's all about attitude. Just really give it 100% hard foot on the accelerator, as hard as you can go, as fast as you can go. And yeah, I'm sure you'll be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super. Finally, our third segment, which is, let's say, personal habits for success.
Yeah,
we kind of dubbed
sure.
it. There was a good question from Mudassar. He was asking, you know, what does the first 2 hours of your day look like before you get to work? If you follow any morning routines?
Yeah, I do. So I think I replied at the time, and I just have to be careful my wife doesn't read it. But, you know, I travel a lot, an awful lot. Some would say a crazy amount, but I do travel an awful lot. So if I'm at home, and I'll answer the question assuming I'm at home, if I'm at home, I really, really try to use the first hour of my day to spend some time with the family, with the kids before they go to school or whatever they're doing. So this morning I sat and had breakfast with my son, which was, and competing with my daughter who's trying to watch her iPad and I'm trying to have a conversation. So it's a very modern world we live in these days. And my children are quite young, they're 8 and 10. So I really try and spend a bit of time with the family, whether it be with my wife or with the kids or walking the dogs or whatever we're doing, but try and get sort of some time with the family. Then, as I think I mentioned on my reply at the time, I read incessantly. I love reading, and so again, normally the best time for me to read, not emails, but read external stuff, is sort of first thing in the morning. So LinkedIn, Twitter, even a bit of Facebook, catch up with what's going on around the world with my friends around the world. So I use that sort of first, I don't know, half an hour, to have a quick scan through what's going on the planet outside of my world. Then if I'm here, and I know physical appearance would suggest otherwise, if I'm in Singapore, I go to the gym do an hour there. I have a trainer there who beats the living daylights out of me, but it's great. And then I come to the office, and then I crack on with work and whatever else I'm doing. So yeah. But I suppose selfishly, the first hour or 2 hours is me with the family, me with myself, or me trying to make sure I'm fit to lead and I've got my head clear for the day.
Another question: what is the book that you give most to people?
I've given out lots and lots and lots of books. Last year, I think at the end of last year, I gave out a book on sort of e-commerce delivery, which is Jonathan Reeve wrote. He's an Australian author who wrote a very good book on sort of a very short, simple book on sort of some of the challenges and opportunities in e-commerce delivery. So I gave that to every one of our managers in case they didn't know. But probably my favourite one is probably Good to Great. I think Good to Great is one of the best books I've ever read. And I love reading, but I think Good to Great is a particularly excellent book. Yeah. And I make this point to a lot of employees. There are a lot of good companies out there, a lot of good employees, but there are a few great. But the margins between good and great are so small, it's untrue. If people realize, I mean, I have 90 people working here in the office here. If you said to me, Charles, tell me about some of your employees, although I have 90, the ones I would tell you about are the ones that stand out in the great category, which are 2, 3, or 4 people, yeah? And the shameful part of that is there could be another 20 or 30, shameful for me, but also shameful for them. There are probably another 20 or 30 people out there. They just made a minimal effort in trying to get more recognition, more visibility to what they're doing would be in that same category. So, you know, I think it's true in sport. I think it's true in business. I tell my son this all the time. My son is 8, and he's a lovely little man. He's always in trouble. But the good news is when I go to his school, every teacher knows him. Every teacher. Not necessarily in a good way.
Yeah,
but they know every teacher knows him. So if you went to that school and said, in his age group, 8, tell me about some of the kids, I guarantee you his name would come up. Henry Brewer, by the way, in case anybody knows him. But his name would come up because he does something to distinguish himself from others. Whether it be good or bad, he does something to distinguish himself from others. And I think, you know, the biggest lesson, I think most companies, most people, most organizations, most employees, my biggest advice to anyone is, you know, find out those 2, 3, 4, 5 things that move you from good to great. And if you do that, you know, I think success follows. So, yeah.
And it's an excellent point. And I mean, I have to share this story because we're working with a client, which I will not name. And I was talking to their global head of HR, which is a fantastic lady. And she was sharing, she has a very progressive mindset. She's all over LinkedIn and she's doing a lot of branding. Uh-huh. And so she should, actually. And then she explained to me, like, look, Radu, I'm struggling, really struggling. Because obviously I'm also quite active on LinkedIn, and I'm struggling to convince my CEOs to go on LinkedIn and take to LinkedIn and, you know, just post stuff there. And I'm like, you know why? You know, why is that? Right? And she says, like, look, I mean, historically the company has been built on a value of being humble.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, understand that being humble, you don't go and, you know, go and broadcast yourself. And I said, but you can be humbly broadcasting yourself, right? Sure. I mean, it's not necessarily...
Sure.
And
it's not boasting or bragging or shouting. It's doing the right things. When I was growing up as a kid, I remember people saying things like, "Oh, you know, he's brown nosing or she's brown nosing." And that phrase, "brown nosing," I think is one of the worst words I've ever heard, because it's not brown nosing. It's about career management. Yeah. And it's so important. And it doesn't, as you, to your point, it's not about bragging or boasting or whatever. I tell my son that as well, be humble. But it's about being noticed. It's about telling the world you exist. It's about telling the employer you exist. It's about telling the school you exist. You know, because otherwise, humans are humans. They just don't notice you. Yeah.
And it's. I mean, we are in Asia. I've been in Asia for 10 years. You've been in Asia for a fair amount of time. And basically, I mean, fundamentally, I get Asian culture, right? Sure. It's the sound of the empty vessel, you know. Do not brag. But we live fundamentally in a world where people want to be connected to you. You need to stand for something. Everybody stands for something, sure. Right? It's not bragging. It's just broadcasting. Who are you, right? And then it's important in the workplace. It's important personally. Sure. It's important as, you know, whatever employer you stand for. You need to represent. You're representing 100%. The brand as well. You, as the CEO of DHL e-commerce, you are the brand. You know, people follow you. So it's fascinating.
I think in life, you know, and again, I'll end the sentence or the question on the same point, which is, you know, my wife sometimes gets very disturbed by my son's antics. My daughter's different, by the way. She's much more studious and much more quiet.
My girls are.
She just focuses on her doing her work, and she's a very bright young lady and young girl and. She's a princess, she can do no wrong. But my son is the opposite, you know. So my wife sometimes gets very, very worried. And I always tell my wife, you needn't worry about Henry. And I said, what? She said, why? And I said, because he's worked out the importance of being noticed. And that's good. Yeah, that's a good thing. We should celebrate it. And and so I do. We celebrate it. We tell him he should be humble, but we celebrate his differences. Yeah.
Perfect. Another question, interesting question. What is something that you believe in that other people think it's insane?
I don't know if other people think it's insane. I've always believed in not forgetting who you are and where you've come from. So, you know, I started my life in DHL as a customer service agent. I was a courier for 3 years, one of the best jobs on the planet, I hasn't read. No one, you say hello in the morning to your boss and then you don't see him until 6 p.m. in the evening. What a great job.
And
you get away with it, yeah. So I come from very humble beginnings. You know, my father, if he was still around, would probably tell you he was particularly worried about me. I think he probably feels about how I feel, or my wife feels about my son. You know, not sure that all is good. But so I come from very humble beginnings. To the point, you know, I remember where I came from. I remember where I was. I remember how I liked to be spoken to. I remember how I liked to be treated. I remember how I didn't like to be spoken to. I remember how I didn't like to be treated. And so when I, you know, in DHL e-commerce, we have 25,000 odd employees. You know, 24,700 of them are fairly junior people trying to enjoy life, go home at night, feed their families, or develop a family, or whatever else it may be. And so, as I said earlier on, we want people to come to work and enjoy it and like it. And so, when they meet me, it better be a positive experience. You know, I talk a lot about being the chief energy officer. So some of the 25,000 people I may only have met ever once, and for 10 seconds or 20 seconds or 30 seconds. So that 10, 20 or 30 seconds better be a pretty good 10, 20 or 30 memorable seconds. So I personally believe that when I go to a market, when I go to a country, or I come in the office, I work hard to engage at every level. And I know that some others potentially feel that's too close in that levels, yeah, at those levels, which I don't agree with. So I think something I firmly believe in, whether other people think it's mad or not, I think you should stay true to who you are, remember where you came from, and make sure you make every possible interaction with every person that you meet as enjoyable as it possibly can be.
Super, yeah. Great answer. Yeah, you definitely give that impression. I mean, I've known you for not that long, but I know you for a bit, and I think, yeah, definitely.
Thank you.
Social media.
Yes.
We need to put it on the table, right? Social media. You're very active on LinkedIn, probably one of the most active CEOs that I have in my network on social media. And it's really something I'm passionate about personally. Yeah. And I'm mind-boggled of how little it seems that people get the impact and influence and power of social media to this day. So you're an active user, influencer, LinkedIn power profile, which is great. Congratulations for
thank
that.
Thank you.
Can you share a little bit more in terms of how does it help you? How does it help your brand? How does it help DHL e-commerce brand? Because maybe more people will.
Yeah, I've always believed in it. You know, so I discovered social media when I was in Africa. So you had 1 billion people in Africa, and most people don't, you know, if I write an article in a paper in South Africa, it's not going to reach Ghana or wherever else, yeah. You know, so that was sort of, and I think it's true, you know, where I operate today, I'm based here, but we cover, you know, the world, it's a pretty big place. So I recognize that social media is a great way to connect with employees and connect with your customers and potential employees and potential customers and stakeholders fairly effectively and very quickly.
Yeah.
So I learned that sort of 4, 5, 6 years ago as a fantastic tool to do that. So that was number one. Number two, like I said earlier on, you know, if you want to be employer of choice, investor of choice, provider of choice, so you, those are our sort of three guiding principles in terms of who we want to be as an organization. If we want to do those three things, you have to connect with them. You know, so I get huge amounts of feedback from employees and customers through digital channels. So, so I use it as a great medium for me to listen, engage, hear, take critique, take praise occasionally, more critique than praise sometimes. But it's a great way of sort of really connecting with your sort of stakeholders very, very fast and very, very effectively. And the third thing is, I think it's just, you know, again, you know, I'm not going to go back to school. I'm a bit late in my life. I'm 52 years now. Although I did think about it the other day. I'm probably not going to go back to school and learn something new. But you can learn so much by what's written and posted on social channels. Like I said earlier on, I spend, you know, half an hour a day reading and learning. And normally they're quite quick reads. You know, they're not sort of 10-day reads, you know, sort of 10 seconds or half an hour or whatever it may be. So you can learn an awful lot of what's going on in your sector or in related sectors or the world by going through social. So I'm a real firm believer. We were talking about it the other day. It's a great way for us to attract talent. It's a great way for us to recruit. Apologies in advance. I do a lot of searching for talent through LinkedIn as an example. So we use LinkedIn a lot to sort of research prospective employees, research prospective customers, engage with existing customers. So I think it's just a way that people do business today. You know, I did that article I think a couple of days ago. I said, if you're not sort of, you know, to other CXOs, if you're not on it, you know, what are you doing? I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, it's the place where your customers are, and especially, you know, in the e-commerce sector, I think more so than others, because our population, our consumer base is pretty young. And, you know,
tech savvy.
My wife is not ringing a call center ever. She's going on Twitter and saying, this is great or this is rubbish. So we do a lot of that, managing and maintaining our customer base through those sort of things, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah. And it's not, I mean, I even, you know, coming from search, executive search, I see that as a complementary. I don't see it as, I mean, fundamentally, I don't see it as a threat to my business.
It's a great talent base.
Yeah. We're going to start selling solutions to companies for employer branding, for social selling, for... I think it's threat and opportunity, right? Depends how you play.
Yeah. I think more for you and for us, more of an opportunity than a threat.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you use it in the right way, I think it's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
And look, again, it's a bit like the e-commerce discussion we had earlier on about threat and opportunity. Yeah. That train has left the station, so far better to be on it and work out how to use it to your advantage than not.
And use it as an enabler. I mean, technology is, you know, you cannot fight technology. I had a very interesting discussion with somebody at the Economic Development Board, actually, in Singapore, and I mean, he was saying that, and he was arguing the case that soon enough, and I think it's going to happen soon enough, people are going to start fighting against technology because they will see technology as taking their jobs. And it's, again, depends how do you play it, right? Because the technology in the core fundamentals of it is an enabler, should not be and will not, I think, be, you know, taking away our jobs, right? But you need to be in a constant time frame and mindset of constant learning, adapt, use the channel that works, to connect to your audience, to connect to your clients, to connect to your...
I totally agree. I mean, I think anybody who thinks they can fight technology, I think, is completely missing the point.
Mm-hmm,
again, same as that e-commerce discussion. The train has left the station, so it's about working out how to play with it and be part of it and use it as a success tool rather than... Again, you can't stop it. It's happened. I do, however, think... And again, I think this is relatively topical. I think you... And you know, going back to the question about I'm on social media, I am, and I'm on it a lot. But you've got to be very careful it doesn't destroy your other values, your other life systems. You know, so I think, you know, sometimes I practice mindfulness and there are moments where I really have to catch myself and say, you know, stop, because you know, I just recently, I was 4 days in Bintan with the family this last weekend, having a break, and I make a very conscious decision that from the moment we leave the room, you know, so from 8 o'clock in the morning until 6 p.m. at night when we come back, don't take my phone, don't take my laptop, don't take anything. It's just, that's family time. And we I only allocate in my head sort of half an hour or so during my off time to catch up with work or LinkedIn or whatever else it may be, because otherwise it can become quite consuming. And I see that in families, I see it in my children, you know, who are consumed with their iPads. I see it myself. So I think it's like everything. It's about getting the right balance, you know, and not too much is not so good, and too little is definitely not very good, and none at all is definitely a mistake. Social is definitely right, the right place to be for most CXOs.
Oh, I've had my fair share. My wife also has given me a pretty hard time with the. Trying to balance it off. You're perfectly right. Yeah, I mean, it's a fine balance. Yeah. It's a fine balance, but okay, such is life in general.
Such
typically,
such is life.
And we're just about close to an end. Just a couple more questions. What has been the biggest letdown in your career so far? Right, we learn a lot also from where we fail.
I was in the US when I think probably two things. I was in the US when we just recently bought a domestic company, and over 2 years trying to make it succeed, and it didn't, and we had to eventually close it down. This is about 8 years ago now, and that was hugely and personally painful. Painful because I wanted it to succeed, and I think it could have succeeded if we'd gone about it the right way, but personally painful because we let a lot of people down, had to lay off a lot of people, so it was one of the hardest periods of my life in DHL, without a doubt. So, but to your point, the upside of that, and there is limited upside, but the upside is I learned an awful lot. I learned an awful lot how not to do things going forward. So, in terms of executing acquisitions or whatever else, but it was a really unpleasant experience, and you know, I still to this day feel very sad about what we went through. So that was be one, and then secondly, and a much happier note, my probably biggest personal dissatisfaction is I still haven't lost 20 kilos. I'm still trying to lose 20 kilos. I've got down to about 10 or 15, but I haven't got down to the 20, so I still have at least another 15 kilos to go. And it drives me mental. It drives me to distraction that I struggle to get those other kilos off. So
maybe we don't need to. Certain things in
maybe
life,
in life it's just not going to happen.
Just accept it. And I know you come from England. You know, you've said it, you're an Arsenal fan. You're a rugby fan as well.
I am, yeah.
You know, in rugby it's an advantage.
An advantage when I played rugby. Not so much now,
so yeah. My father was a rugby player. He's not particularly slim either. So
it helps in rugby.
It helps in rugby. What kind of industry events do you find useful? I mean, is there any industry event that you would recommend? You know, good sharing?
Yeah, there's lots actually. So I mentioned earlier on that one of the things we, you know, Sharon and I had decided when we first got together about a year ago was that DHL e-commerce didn't have a particularly strong position in the marketplace around, you know, what we were doing, you know, to all the stakeholders that we talked about endlessly. So you know, we made a decision that we were going to speak at a lot more events. And, you know, you can't really delegate that activity. That has to be the CEO. So, again, it causes a bit of travel congestion here and there. I think there's some really fantastic events around Asia, some really fantastic events in Europe, and there's some really fantastic events in the US. The trick is choosing the right ones and the ones that you can have really fit with what you're trying to achieve. So that's been hugely successful. Outside of that, we, you know, again, not too many other things. I mean, we get involved as an organization. DHL sponsors a lot of activities, so we sponsor Manchester United, rather sadly, from my perspective.
As an Arsenal fan,
that causes some consternation. We sponsor Bayern Munich, who were here last week.
That's okay.
Last week,
enemies there.
That's not so bad, and they're a great club actually. So I enjoy. Although they did ask me, how do you deal with sort of the quandary of being an Arsenal fan and having to wear a Bayern Munich shirt? I said I can get past it.
Yeah.
But so we sponsor that. We sponsor F1 and we sponsor Formula E, which is a sort of new electronic Formula Formula Racing, which is fantastic, really supports and supplements our drive to become a zero emissions organisation. So we're really proud of that. It's really taking off like no one's business. So we sponsor a lot of activities. So we get to go to and attend a lot of those events, which we get to take a lot of our customers, which is fantastic. So it's nice to spend a bit of time with either our employees or customers in a more social setting. So yeah. That's quite nice. Other than that, I don't really have time for many other things. So that's probably about it, I think, isn't it? Yeah.
Got it. What are you using? So you mentioned you take your information out of LinkedIn, out of Twitter. Are you using any apps, any other sort of, pieces of useful technology that you use to stay abreast of?
Not really. I mean, I mentioned LinkedIn and Twitter primarily. There's a few other ones around, like... we have an app which is a DHL application which called Yammer, which actually not a DHL Yammer. Application, it's available. It's Y-A-M-M-E-R, but we use that to set up groups across DHL to talk to as many people as we possibly can.
So that's internal, yeah?
Yeah, it's okay. Internal. So we do a lot of that. So that's quite good, actually, because, and again, going back to the point about sort of getting, really fast information. So we use that quite a lot for e-commerce to sort of push out information to our customers, to our employees, but also to listen to their feedback. So just recently, for example, in the US, I wanted to find out some information around how well one of our products was going. So I asked our employees in the US, and within seconds I had lots and lots of feedback about what was good and what's bad. And again, to the point early on about, what do I do that others may think is mad? Some people may think that's crazy, but my personal opinion is, if you really want to know how something is going, don't ask the manager, ask the courier, or ask the ops agent, or ask the warehouse person. They will tell you the truth about how something is going. So I use a lot of those sort of platforms to get very fast research. Yeah, I wish I could do the same for customers. I have to work out how I can do the same for customers. But certainly from an employee perspective, we use that quite a bit. Yeah.
Super. Final question. If you could go back and give your 21-year-old self a valuable piece of advice, what would you say?
Don't eat that burger. No, I'd probably... I've been asked this a couple of times before, actually. I don't know. It's a really tough one. I probably would say... There's nothing in my life I would change. I've loved all 33 years. I've been 100... Or with DHL, I've been 110... 52 years in life, but 33 years with DHL. I've been to 110 countries in one way, working or visiting, but 110 countries. I've met football stars, rugby. I've had an amazing life, amazing opportunities. So there's nothing I would change. I would probably tell my 20-year-old version, go harder, go faster, and stand out even more. Yeah.
Super.
Yeah.
Charles, great sharing. Thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. For making the time to share with us.
My pleasure.
And catch you soon.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers. Thank you all for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radopalamariu.com/podcast for all the show notes and links and extra tips covered in the interview. Also, make sure you subscribe to our emailing list at the bottom of the page to get the news in the nick of time. I am most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest podcasts and articles. And make sure not to miss our next episode. We are talking with somebody who is similar to a Jason Bourne of logistics. Worked across several continents, served for the US Senate and G20, set up successful logistics businesses in China, India, Southeast Asia and USA. He's a fervent speaker and contributor on the latest topics in supply chain, and he is probably one of the most interesting logisticians we have in our network, Paul Bradley. Look forward to a great sharing, and we shall keep you posted. Stay tuned.